You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, given in 1917. This is Lecture 1, entitled A Key to the Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha. In the course of these lectures, I shall have occasion to call attention to certain features of our studies, which must influence all spiritual science at the present day. The nature of these is such that care must be taken that behind all the conceptions and ideas formed by man, and according to which he lives, there should not only be logic, but that reality also should dwell in them. People must seek for ideas that are steeped in truth, and it is not superfluous in respect of these, our studies, to point out again and again how comprehensible it is that an idea may be true in a certain sense, and yet not reach down to reality. What exactly is meant by ideas being steeped in reality will only emerge gradually. The thought may, however, be arrived at by a simple analogy. So, by way of an introduction, I will illustrate what I mean by this method. What I am about to tell you may seem to have no connection with what is to follow, but this want of connection is only apparent. During the papal rule of Pope Sextus V, which lasted from 1585 to 1590, he deposited in the fortress of St. Angelo the sum of 5 million scudi as a treasure against times of serious need, and all the cardinals of Rome were obliged to take a solemn oath to preserve this treasure intact. In the year 1839, however, under the rule of Pope Gregory, Cardinal Acton refused to take the oath as the others had done. If nothing more of the story had been heard than this, all kinds of suppositions might have arisen as to why this well-known cardinal had refused to take the oath to preserve the treasure. What might have been said might have been entirely logical, but all such logic vanishes in face of certain facts that were known to Cardinal Acton, though not to the others, namely, that since 1790 no fund had existed. It had already been spent. The cardinals were permitted to swear to preserve a treasure that did not exist. Acton would not consent to this, and all the fine discussions that might have sprung up round the fact would have been useless. If we meditate upon such an example as this, it often seems superfluous to reflect upon such obvious cases, but we must think about them and compare them with other situations in life. If we meditate upon such an example as this, we can grasp the difference between concepts rooted in reality and those which are not. Now I must draw your attention to the unreality of ideas today, because, as you will see later, this is closely connected with the subject of these lectures. A subject that I must touch upon once again from the point of view of spiritual science. I will endeavor to relate the investigations which we have already undertaken to the study of a certain aspect of the mystery of Christ. My last contribution to this subject will serve as a framework for that aspect of the Christ mystery which I now propose to examine. But first of all, I should like to put before you certain things which are seemingly unrelated to our main theme, because they will provide an invaluable background to our studies. In my book titled Christianity as Mystical Fact, which appeared some years ago, I ventured to indicate a certain way in which one could approach the mystery of Christ. This book, which in its new edition was one of the last books to be confiscated by the old regime in Russia, was a first attempt to interpret Christianity from a spiritual standpoint, a standpoint which in the course of centuries has been more or less lost to Christianity during its development in the West. Now I should like to emphasize one thing in particular, for this will determine whether the arguments advanced in my book are valid or not. In this book I have adopted a definite attitude toward the Gospels. I do not wish to enter into further details at the moment, for my point of view is explicitly stated in the book. But if I am justified in my point of view, we shall have to assume that the origin of the Gospels is not nearly so late as contemporary Christian theology often assumes, but that an early date must probably be assigned to them. You know that from the standpoint of spiritual science, the origins of the Gospel teaching are to be found in the ancient mystery teachings. We must see the mystery of Golgotha as a fulfillment of these ancient teachings. Now, such a spiritual conception will run counter to the exegeses of modern historians and theologians, who will regard it, no doubt, as historically unsound. Now, it is fairly evident that the Gospels did not exercise any significant influence during the first century, or at least during the first two-thirds of this century. There are indeed Christian theologians today who doubt whether any evidence can be adduced that in the first century of the Christian era, people of consequence thought of or even believed in the person of Jesus Christ. Now, it will become increasingly evident that if the careful research of the present day broadens its scope and shows itself to be Catholic as well as conscientious, then there will be an end to its many scruples. Of course, it is possible to draw all kinds of conclusions from certain discrepancies between the Christian and Jewish records. But the fact that the apocryphal Gospels, that is, those not officially recognized by the Christian Church, are very little known today and are virtually ignored, especially by Christian theologians, militates against these conclusions. The reason for this lack of recognition is that, to a large extent, Christianity, and especially the mystery of Golgotha, are not apprehended with sufficient spirituality. There was no real understanding of the Pauline distinction between the psychic and the spiritual man. Corinthians 1, chapters 15, verses 44 and 45. Consider for a moment our division of man into body, soul, and spirit, one of the fundamental conceptions of anthroposophy. In reality, Paul, who was familiar with the atavistic character of the truths of the ancient mysteries, implied the same as we imply today when we speak of soul and spirit as two members of human nature. This distinction between soul and spirit has virtually been lost in the West. But we cannot understand the real nature of the mystery of Golgotha unless we have a clear understanding of the distinction between psychic man and spiritual man. Now, first of all, I should like to cite an example, which I also referred to some years ago, in order to show you that the facts of external history are often falsely interpreted, especially in relation to the recent investigations into the life of Jesus. I refer to the generally accepted view that the Gospels are of late provenance. Now, many objections can be raised against this view on purely historical grounds. It can, for example, be proved that in the 70th year of our era, Rabbi Gamaliel II was concerned in a lawsuit, the facts of which were as follows. Rabbi Gamaliel II was the son of Rabbi Simon, who is the son of that Gamaliel of whom Paul was a pupil. Gamaliel II had a sister with whom he went to law about an inheritance. The case came before a judge who was a Roman and who had leanings toward Christianity, or perhaps he was a Jew with leanings toward Christianity. This is not easy to prove. Gamaliel maintained that he was the only heir to the inheritance, because according to Mosaic law, women could not inherit. The judge replied, quote, "Since you Jews have lost your country, the law of Moses holds no longer, but the law of the Gospel holds, that according to the Gospel, sisters can also inherit." Close quote. Therefore, nothing could be done, honestly, at least. What happened? Gamaliel was not only grasping, but cunning. He proposed an adjournment of the proceedings, as we would now say. This was granted, and in the interval Gamaliel II bribed the judge. At the second trial he appeared before the same judge, and this time the judge gave a different verdict. He said that at the first trial he had made a mistake, that the gospel certainly might refer to such cases, but that the law of Moses was not annulled by it. And the 17th verse of the 5th chapter of Matthew, where it speaks of the permanence of the law, was quoted in confirmation. In passing sentence, the judge simply refers to the Gospel of Matthew, and the Talmud, which retails these events, speaks quite as a matter of course of the Gospel of Matthew. Many things might be brought forward in extension of the existing careful investigations to prove that we have no firm grounds for supposing that the Gospels were comparatively late in appearing. Even historical investigation will one day confirm that which is derived from purely spiritual sources, and which forms the foundation of my book, Christianity is Mystical Fact. Everything connected with the mystery of Golgotha has concealed within it the most profound mysteries, which will be gradually solved when spiritual science has made further progress. Many things indicate that questions connected with this mystery are not so simple as is frequently supposed. For instance, the way in which the Judaism of the first century was related to contemporary opinions held regarding Jesus Christ, which is not sufficiently considered at the present time. There are theologians who study certain Jewish writings in order to find out and prove many things. Only it can be demonstrated historically that these Jewish writings, on which so much is based, did not exist in the first Christian century. One thing does seem to be demonstrable historically, and that is that in the first century, especially in the second third of it, comparatively good relations existed between Christian and Jew. That when open-minded Jews met to discuss certain questions with the followers of Jesus Christ, it was not difficult for them to arrive at harmony of opinion. We need but recall such well-known cases as that of Rabbi Eliezer, who, about the middle of the first century, became acquainted with a certain James, Jacob, as he calls him, who admitted to having been a pupil of Jesus, and to have healed in the name of Jesus Christ. This rabbi, Eliezer, had spoken with James and thereafter came to the conclusion that what James said was in no sense contrary to the inner spirit of Judaism, nor indeed was his healing of the sick man, his healing of the sick in the name of Jesus Christ. This pleasing tendency to a greater or lesser degree of harmony disappeared toward the end of the first century. In other words, even open-minded Jews became implacable enemies, hating everything Christian. Thus in the second century, when those writings that are held to be of such great importance were written, an entirely different spirit to that which had existed in the first century appeared between Christian and Jew. Hand in hand with this, a change had taken place also in Judaism itself. Granted that the modern upholders of Judaism know the Old Testament in their own way, yet they do not know what still lived in Judaism at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. They misunderstand many of the main facts with which an historical study of this period is really concerned. We must realize that the way in which the Old Testament was read by learned Jewish rabbis, even in the early Christian centuries, was quite different from the way it is read today. The faculty for reading ancient writings has to a great extent been lost, more especially since the beginning of the 19th century. Certain things which still remained in the 18th century as a secret tradition, connected with the truths of the old clairvoyance, could no longer be thought or imagined by the man of the 19th. People who write of such things today, even when the facts referred to belong to much earlier times, are regarded as foolish persons. In former lectures, I have drawn your attention to a remarkable book by de Saint-Martin called, I'm going to try this, De Erreurs et de la Vérité. I'll spell it for you. D-E-S, and then the second word, E-R-R, E-U-R, E-S, Erreurs et de la Vérité. Sorry. This book is in a certain sense a belated product, insofar as it speaks to us from out what has now become a shadowy tradition, an ancient way of regarding things. But it does speak from out this tradition. I have quoted a great deal recently from this book. It is a book of which modern men do not know what to think. If we adopt St. Martin's own special point of view, however, we shall see that, in his opinion, certain things exist which to modern man are sheer lunacy, unless they are regarded as images. Thus, St. Martin suggests that the human race has sunk to its present condition from a very early primeval one. Many people who do not hold entirely with the materialistic point of view still believe, in an abstract way, that the human race can be traced back to a far distant time, when, with a part of its being, it stood at a higher level than it does now. In spite of the material taint of Darwinianism, which holds that man has descended from animals, there are some people who believe in his divine origin, from whence he received a divine tradition. But when we go beyond this abstraction and arrive at such concrete statements as are found in St. Martin, the modern man cannot in the least understand them. What can a man of today who has absorbed biology, physiology, geology, and chemistry, as also that wonderful compilation which is called philosophy, what can such a man think when he reads in St. Martin, quote, "The human race, as it is today, first became such after the fall. Originally, it was entirely different. Originally, man was equipped with a crossbow and armor. This armor he has lost. Originally, it was part of his organism, and protected by it he could endure the great strife through which he had to pass in primeval times. He also possessed a lance of bronze, which could injure as fire injures. By the aid of this lance, he could overcome beings other than human, in the struggle at that time imposed on him. In the place where man originally dwelt, he had for his maintenance 7 trees, each of which had 16 roots and 490 branches. This place he has now forsaken. He has descended from it." Close quote. I do not think anyone could be considered to be quite in his right mind if he desired the complete reality of these visions in the same way as geologists desire the reality of the admirable constructions they build up regarding primeval ages. People cannot help searching out all kinds of symbols and allegories, but as a matter of fact, the stories become somewhat distorted when this is done. But St. Martin did not mean these as allegories. He spoke of realities that existed originally. He necessarily had to make use of imagination in speaking of certain things that took place in earlier conditions of the earth, for originally this was much more spiritual than it became later. Imaginations, however, represent realities. They should not be accepted as symbols, but according to their imaginative content. I merely touch on this, not wishing to go further into the matter at present. I only wish to show how fundamentally different was the language employed in a book like Des Erreurs et de la Vérité, I'm trying that, forgive me, which appeared as late as the 18th century, to that we regard as alone representing reality today. The style employed by de Saint Martin has entirely died out, but the Old Testament, for example, can only be read in all its depth if people still understand or have reacquired certain things that are connected with imaginative conceptions. It is easy to see that, especially in the 19th century, the possibility of reading the Old Testament aright has been lost. We find, however, the further back we go, that a very living knowledge of the ancient mysteries existed among the Jews at the time of the mystery of Golgotha, that alongside the Old Testament there existed a real understanding of the viewpoint of the mysteries. Much of this wisdom consisted in the power it gave of reading the Old Testament aright. Now it is quite impossible to read this book aright if its statements regarding spiritual matters are not accepted as a background to this reading. At the time of the mystery of Golgotha, Rome was specially adverse to the peculiar note of the Jewish mysteries. There has perhaps hardly ever been a greater antagonism in earthly evolution than that between the spirit of Rome and the views held in the mysteries, as preserved to us by the initiates of Palestine. We cannot call the views held by the mystery schools of Palestine Christian, but only a foretaste of Christianity. On the other hand, what is most vital to Christianity only becomes comprehensible when considered with the historical background of the mystery teachings of Palestine. This teaching was full of hidden knowledge concerning the spirit of man, concerning the man of spirit, full of indications that might aid the human understanding to find the path to the spiritual world. Much that was contained in this mystery teaching was also to be found in manifold ramifications in the mysteries of Greece, but only to a slight extent in those of Rome. Romanism could make but little use of that which was the very core of the mysteries of Palestine. It could not do so because Rome evolved such a special form of communal life, as was only possible when the man of spirit, in quotes, was left out of account. The true secret of Roman history is contained in the fact that by her a communal life was founded which left the spirit more or less out of account. Her task was to found a society in which it would be meaningless to speak of man as a threefold being, that is, as a being consisting of body, soul, and spirit. The further back we go, the more do we find that long ago it was precisely on this partition of man that a comprehension of the mystery of Golgotha was founded. If this mystery is to be understood by us, it must be in the spirit in which Paul speaks throughout the physical, the psychic, and the spiritual man. This was bound to give great offense to every feeling a Roman had, and explains much that followed later. You are well aware that the mental outlook which sought in those days to preserve this threefold partition of man and of the world was Gnosticism, which is today no longer practicable. As evolution progressed, this point of view was more or less eliminated, and later was suppressed altogether, so that it has entirely disappeared. I do not say that Gnosticism should have been preserved, but merely point out the fact that Gnostics cherished a spiritual conception of the mystery of Golgotha, and that they were suppressed. A strange development followed. Christianity entered more and more into the essential nature of Rome, but the more it penetrated, the more Rome failed to understand it in its relationship to the spiritual part of man, and certain Christian Gnostics gave more and more offense through speaking always of body, soul, and spirit. In those Roman circles where Christianity had become official, the attempt was increasingly made to exclude and conceal all idea of the spirit, and by doing so, it was thought to suppress all idea of the threefold partition of man. So evolution went on. And when the early Christian centuries are studied with sufficient exactness, it will be found that much which is usually explained otherwise is seen in its true light when we recognize that as Christianity assumed an official Roman character, it was ever more concerned with the complete exclusion of the idea of the Spirit. Innumerable questions are first seen in their true light when we recognize the necessity of Europeanized Christianity setting aside the Spirit. In its further development, this led to the Eighth Ecumenical Council of 869, establishing a dogma which, though its original wording may not have been very clear, yet led to its being interpreted as declaring it to be unchristian to speak of body, soul, and spirit, and truly Christian to speak of man as consisting of body and soul alone. At first, this was only formulated as follows, quote, "Man is possessed of an imaginative and spiritual soul," close quote. This formula was constructed so as not to mention the spirit as a special entity. Man had an, quote, "imaginative and spiritual soul," close quote. Very much is connected with this, of which men are not aware. Modern philosophers are ever investigating with their thoughts that which, on one side, is corporeal, and on the other, psychic. Were you to ask persons like B. Wundt, or men of a similar type of intellect, on what this conception was founded, they would naturally believe that it was founded on reality, on true observation, that sprang from a feeling that there was no sense in speaking of body, soul, and spirit, but only of body, which directs man to outward things, and soul, which directs him inward. What else could such a man say? He had no idea that this was the result of the Eighth Ecumenical Council. Modern philosophers do not speak of the Spirit. They follow the dogma laid down at the Council, and the reason for this is that they are as much in ignorance as were the Roman cardinals when they swore to protect a treasure that no longer existed. The pregnant events of history, the real forces, are often those to which so distressingly little thought is given, and so we are kept in ignorance. If we are not in accord with the, quote, "nothing without proof," close quote, science, as it is called, which asserts that man consists of body and soul alone. The people who support this, in quotes, "science," do not know that, in this case, the assumptions were those of the Ecumenical Council in the year 869. It is the same in many cases, and we can indeed regard this council as a most important window through which light is thrown on a great part of Western evolution. You know of the deep rift that occurred in the whole civilized world of the West in consequence of the difference in the forms of religion, and which continues to the present time, between the Orthodox Russian Church and the Roman Catholic Church. It is purely dogmatic acceptance. The difference lies in the celebrated filioque. The Roman Church, according to later councils, recognized the formula that the Holy Spirit proceeds, quote, "from the Father and the Son," close quote, not from the Father alone, but also from the Son. This was declared to be heretical by Constantinople. The Russian Church, which only recognizes the first seven councils, pronounced that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father. The great confusion in respect of this dogma could, of course, only arise through confusion in the conception of the Holy Spirit, and because all idea as to the Holy Spirit had been gradually lost. This is certainly connected with the fact that when the fifth post-Atlantean period drew near, men had for a time to be withheld from the recognition of the Spirit. What took place in respect of this truth is what might be called a reflection, playing over the surface of the truth. But we must see through the reflection to what lies beyond it if we are to arrive at valid opinions, the truth of which satisfies us. Now the period of evolution that contained the important moment when these dogmas were laid down has hardly yet come to an end. The Christian theologians of the Middle Ages, who still held the direct tradition, the alchemists and others who followed the old tradition, knew for certain that man consisted of body, soul, and spirit. It was indeed only the Orthodox Church teaching that maintained that he consisted of body and soul alone. The theologians of the Middle Ages knew how difficult it was to be orthodox on the one hand, and on the other to recognize that there was something in the heretical teaching which everywhere survived. We see how these theologians twist and turn, yet are unable to evade trichotomy, or the division of man into three principles. And if these difficulties are not recognized, they cannot be understood. The evolutionary period just referred to has not long come to an end, and its end coincides with an extraordinarily important impulse in Western civilization. Moreover, many things have come to pass in the 20th century through this impulse, which must be recognized if the present epoch is to be understood. Originally, then, if such a word may be used in speaking of something that has arisen in comparatively recent times, man's being was separated into three principles, body, soul, and spirit. As a rule, it is not noticed that by the 9th century, the course of evolution was such that it had become possible to set aside the spirit for things of such moment as the complete change that had taken place in thought since the time of St. Martin are often passed by. The tendency did not end with the abolition of the spirit. Things went further. There was an inclination to abolish the soul also. The momentous tendency of this age is not clearly recognized. We are standing at a most important moment of our evolution, in which preparation is being made for the abolition of the soul. Councils are not indeed summoned now to decide this, as was done in the 9th century. Things are done differently today. Once more, I lay stress on the fact that I do not criticize. I merely lay the facts before you. Considerable progress has been made in the abolition of the soul in many domains. For instance, in the 19th century, what is called historical materialism made its appearance. This has, since, become the fundamental viewpoint of the socialistic democracy of the present day. If Engels and Marx are held to be the chief prophets of historical materialism, although the ancient word prophet hardly applies here, they are also the direct descendants, historically speaking, of the 8th Ecumenical Council. We have here an unbroken line of development. What the Church Fathers did toward abolition of the spirit, Marx and Engels carried further in their comprehensive attempt to abolish the soul. According to them, soul impulses are no longer worth considering. The forces that drive history forward are material forces, the struggle for material well-being. What appertains to the soul, they say, is but a superstructure on the real foundation of the facts of material progress. It is well to recognize the genuine Catholicity of Marx and Engels, for it is important to note in these aspirations of the 19th century the true sequel of the abolition of the spirit. A further impulse to this abolition is found in the recently evolved conception of the world according to natural science. These conceptions are the direct sequel of what came about through the important events to which I am referring. I do not mean natural science itself, but the views it holds. These are that it is the body alone that matters, and everything of a soul nature is but a superstructure on what is corporeal. The greater part of mankind probably will not believe this, till among certain centers in approaching evolution, the abolition of the soul will have acquired more or less legal force. Before very long, laws will be passed in several states equivalent to a declaration that all who speak seriously of the soul are not right in their minds. Those only being of an entirely sound mind who recognize that thought, feeling, and will arise involuntarily out of certain bodily processes. The first half of this century will hardly have passed before, to those who have insight, terrible things will have happened in this respect, which will be a challenge to soul, similar to that challenge to spirit that occurred in the 9th century. It cannot be too often stated that it is insight into things like these that is so vitally important, clear insight into the impulses within which man has lived in the course of historical evolution. It is all too true that through the training given today, in accordance with the materialistic outlook, man has given way to a certain condition of somnolence. Materialism precludes men from thinking clearly. It lulls them to sleep, and they do not give heed to things that are vital in historical evolution. This is the case today, even with those who would fain follow a distinct longing for spiritual knowledge. They have not sufficient strength of will to rouse themselves to overcome certain impulses and to look at things as they really are. Now there existed in Palestine certain mystery teachings which were a preparation for the mystery of Golgotha, and in respect of which this may be considered a fulfillment. It was this to which I referred when I said in the mystery of Golgotha the greatest mystery in all the world was played out upon the stage of history. If this was the case, why, we may ask, did the spirit of Rome evolve such a strong antipathy to Christianity in connection with the mystery of Golgotha? And how was it that through this antipathy, spirit was rejected? These things have an infinitely deeper connection than is usually noticed by those who only study them superficially. That Marx and Engels are church fathers would not be admitted by many today. This is of no great moment, but it leads to something of far greater moment when we keep in mind the following. In the judgment hall where Jesus Christ was judged, the Sadducees took a prominent part. What were the Sadducees at the time when the mystery of Golgotha took place? They were those who desired utterly to destroy everything which proceeded from the ancient mysteries. They had a fear, a horror of these mysteries. The law courts were in their hands, and it was they who controlled Palestine at that time. They were completely under the influence of Rome. One might say that they were the slaves of Rome. This was evident through the fact that they bought the posts that held, for large sums of money, which they extorted in their turn from the people of Palestine. Driven thereto by their Ahrimanic, materialistic outlook, it was they who recognized the great danger that confronted the rule of Rome, should it by any means come to be held that the deeds of Christ were in accordance with the spirit of the mysteries. They had an instinctive feeling that from Christianity something would come forth that would gradually overthrow Rome, and with this feeling is connected the fact that in the early centuries and also later, such a fierce war was waged against the spirit of Judaism in Palestine. This war of destruction, which was of a dreadful kind, was prosecuted mainly because they held that in slaughtering the Jews, those were also destroyed who knew anything of the traditions and the realities of the ancient mysteries. Everything connected in any way with the spirit of the mysteries, once existing in Palestine, was to be destroyed root and branch. All this was closely connected with the destruction of man's perception of what was spiritual in himself. It would have gone badly with those who sought later, by means of Romanized Christianity, to abolish the spirit if any of those had remained who still had knowledge of the ancient schools of learning in Palestine, if any had been left who knew the path to the spirit, and could still bear witness to the fact and prove that man consisted of body, soul, and spirit. The outcome of Romanism was that something had to be established that was connected with the external ordering of humanity, something that did not make any demands on the search for the spirit. Verily, In it, the spirit did not require to be sought. A type of evolution had to be introduced, from which all spiritual impulse was excluded. This could not have come to pass if too many people had known the interpretation of the mystery of Golgotha as it was known in the mysteries. It was felt instinctively that what sprang from the rule of Rome could not contain anything appertaining to the Spirit. The main result of the union between the Church and the Roman state was jurisprudence. In this the Spirit had no part. It is important to note this, and it is equally important that we should note that we are now living in an age when the Spirit must be evoked once more, so that it does participate in the affairs of men. This will not be easy because things have gone too far, and I believe they will go yet further before people recognize, to any wide extent, that a materialistic investigation of historic events is a true product of the Eighth Ecumenical Council. I believe also that a yet longer road will have to be traveled before people understand what really lies in those few letters which form the distinction between the Eastern and the Western Church in Europe. People are content today merely in speaking of and estimating these things in a superficial way. Much will have to be brought to birth by feeling, and this feeling will only be in the right direction if one thing is kept clearly in mind. Anyone who makes a genuine study of the true history of Europe from the rise of Christianity onward, and has the courage to examine for himself the inventions called history today, will arrive at a feeling which will prove a true guide to him in his investigations of the present age, and the place it holds in the evolution of humanity. He will discover, for instance, that nothing has suffered so many hindrances, so much obscuration and misrepresentation as the evolution of Christianity. Nothing has ever been so difficult as the spread of Christianity. And from this feeling will spring the further one, that when miracles are mentioned, there is no greater miracle than this, that Christianity has endured. Christianity does not only exist, but we live in an age in which it will have to be given effect to, in spite of this, quote, abolition of the Spirit, close quote, of which I have been speaking. It is in the period of bitterest opposition that Christianity will develop its greatest power. Power will be evoked through this very attempt to abolish spirit, which will force its recognition once more. When from the spirit that prevails today, pardon such a misuse of the word, laws are passed pronouncing those to be of unsound mind who regard spirit as reality, when the declaration of the Eighth Ecumenical Council has thus been fulfilled in its modern form, the time will have arrived when the Spirit will come once again into its own. People will then be forced to recognize that we are not here dealing with shadowy conceptions, and the profound feeling at the back of these ideas, their deep origin, will be then understood, as they are not understood today. Much is hidden behind these uncertain conceptions, which the modern man can in no way understand, but in which he must acquiesce. And because he does not do so, nor acknowledge them outwardly, mental conflict has arisen in him. In a certain most important passage, St. Martin says, quote, "Such things are not to be spoken of," close quote. Certainly, for a long time, there will be many things that cannot be spoken of, and many things that will have to be engraven, as it were, on tablets of bronze, in order to prove to mankind what is actually the case. The end of Lecture 1.